When the modern struggle for gay rights erupted, most notably at a bar called Stonewall in Greenwich Village in the summer of 1969, most religious traditions condemned homosexuality. Psychiatric experts label people who are attracted to others of the same sex crazy, and 49 states outlawed sex between people of the same gender. Four decades later, in June 2011, New York legalized gay marriage, the most populous state in the country to do so thus far. The armed services stopped enforcing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, ending a law that had long discriminated against gay and lesbian members of the military. Successful social movements are always extraordinary, but these advances are something of a miracle, according to political columnist Linda Hirschman, who recounts the long roads that led to these victories in her book, Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution. Linda Hirschman, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Should note that Linda is going to be talking about and signing her book this Sunday, July 8th, at the Rolof Jansen Community Library in Copaig, and we'll talk more about that event at the end of the segment, but it's exciting you'll be doing that. And I read the book last week, and it really is stunning in the scope and in the introduction, get a sense of it, of where we were just four decades ago and where we are now. Do you think there is one tidal wave that occurred in this, or has it just been chipping away little by little?
I think that there were several waves. One started in 1950 when Harry Hay founded the first self-consciously political American gay organization, the Mattachine Society. And another, and as is often the case with social movements, there was pushback. And another wave really rolled over the society starting in the 60s, not specifically with Stonewall, but building in the 60s and then, in a sense, cresting at Stonewall. And then the third wave, I would say, probably was after the AIDS epidemic, when people stopped dying. And at that point, the community was much strengthened by the efforts they had made to fight the disease. And so I would date the modern gay revolution to 1997, when the new medicines became widely available.
One of the things that comes out so clearly in the book is that this cooperation with even the with the straight community so helped the gay community in achieving many of these victories.
It's an interesting subject. Sometimes the straight community was really missing in action, as in New York City when the AIDS epidemic started. That was a terrible time, and the politicians and the community leaders were really not helping in a critical moment. Sometimes the straight community was terrific. Jean Manford, the mother of a very famous gay activist from the early 70s, started something called PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, and they have done yeoman service to help the movement. It was a straight psychologist, Evelyn Hooker, who first began the battle against categorizing homosexuality as a mental illness. So it's a mixed record. I think the gay revolution got powerful straight allies when they were strong enough to have something worth allying with. So movements almost never flourish in alliance or in concert with other forces until they're strong enough to have something to make them worth paying attention to. And that's clearly the story here, as I describe at length in my book. The accretion of power preceded the ability to trade it in a meaningful way.
I was struck, and I'll get back to the book in just a moment, but you know, when the President of the United States comes out recently and says that I have been on this journey and I now support gay marriage, is that a victory, or do you turn and say, yes, that's a victory, but why are you late to the table?
I think it's a victory. It's absolutely a victory. When people attacked me for calling my book Victory, the attacks for calling it Victory started right before Barack Obama announced it. And so I was like, Victory, not a good title. Barack Obama announces for gay marriage. Victory, not a good title. The United States Court of Appeals announces for gay marriage. Of course, these are victories. I don't know how late to the table he was. If you want help from a politician, you have to make it worth his while to give it to you, or too painful to withhold it. And the gay revolutionaries during the Obama administration made it too painful for him to withhold it. And they succeeded brilliantly. So I credit them, the bloggers, the broadcasters, John Arvosis, they really were the people who kept the pressure up on Barack Obama. I don't blame him for behaving like a politician. He's the president of the United States.
Do you understand do you think it is political rhetoric, or do you understand the thought process of it being a journey and working through it in your mind of working through your concerns?
Well, that's an interesting question. Because the gay movement faced all of the concerns that a movement can face. They were considered sinful by religions.
Right.
They were treated as crazy by the psychologists. They were considered subversive by Joseph McCarthy and the Congress of the United States and President Eisenhower. They were considered criminal criminal in all 50 states until the 60s. So you can't have harsher concerns to battle than those four concerns. I do think that by 2011, a sophisticated and educated and urban guy like Barack Obama probably should have figured out that gay people were not crazy, criminal, subversive, or sinful. I take it that sinful was the last thing left in his mind, because he refers to the church in his statement. But we do have constitutional provisions that really forbid you from taking the church's definition of sin as your guide to what our civil society should look like.
Well, there's even some question about that, right? About whether it is considered sinful in the Bible.
Well, yes. Interestingly, one of the many wonderful things that the gay revolution is doing, as I say in my book, is changing America for everyone. So the book is full of examples of the way in which the gay revolution had to fight the concept. So they had to fight, as in your example, the concept of sinful. And in doing so, they have gone back to the text, to the Old Testament and the New and the letters of Paul and so forth, and proposed a revision of the notion of what constitutes sin that would affect many things beyond homosexual sexual relations. I don't believe that a political society should adopt what the church says one way or the other, but I think for believers it would be very liberating and helpful if they succeeded in reconstructing the historical record so that it would be questionable whether it was actually sinful or not. I don't think we ought to be following rules about good behavior that were laid down in the year 1 or 5,000 years ago if you take the Old Testament, okay? I don't think
right.
We ought to be doing that. But for people who do think that, the gay revolution is now addressing itself to the very concept of what constitutes sin.
And that fact that a loving God would not want you to hate anyone for
right.
No matter what.
There's that, and also there are texts in both the Old Testament and the New that says that it's good and godly for people to find love and to make permanent loving relationships with other
yeah.
adults. So the argument is that rule, that concept in Judaism and Christianity is more powerful than a handful of statements about spilling your seed and stuff. So that appeals to me, the idea that the Bible has an overall tilt in favor of loving adult human relationships, moral adult human relationships, and that therefore that larger narrative would trump this handful of texts to the contrary.
There is This book is fascinating, and there's so many different facets to this movement and to the book that you've written. But one of the things that really struck me is that just the attitudes of people and how they've changed, and through the, for want of a better term, the debate over the years over gay marriage, of how communities have come together, and there seems to be that moment where it's because people, when you put a face on it and you see that it's your neighbor and you see that it's a couple, and it's men and women who live in your town, who are in your school, who are in your church, and they're doing things, that it seems to change it. Okay, well, why wouldn't they be able to get married? They've been together longer than we have, you know, and so why wouldn't they? And that really is, I mean, that's more than, obviously this whole movement has been more than grassroots, but that has been an aspect of it, hasn't it? Oh, that's okay. Is that your phone?
I'm sorry.
All right.
Sorry.
That's all right. I'll let you sign. Nice ringtone, though.
Yeah, jazz piano thing.
That's very
for
nice.
Your listeners,
we
stop this program for a musical interlude from the I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
You know, it's an interesting thing because, of course, gay people are scattered by fiat of biology. Gay people are scattered throughout the population.
Right.
Right? Rich, poor, white, black, green, yellow, pink, urban, rural.
Right.
Right. So everybody knows some gay person if the person would only come out of the closet. And so seeing them as friends and relatives is helpful. But first they had to stake a claim to and achieve basic inclusion in humanity. Jews lived among the Christians in Germany. It did not save them. So for a long time, people treated gay people and lesbian people as if they were not fully human. They were morally flawed at the heart. And they had to overcome that and allow people to see them as fully human before they could take advantage of that last piece of it, which is, and they should be happy in the way that we're happy, or they should be happy in every human way. So it was a more complicated battle than that. And I think that what was such fun about the book was that you could, as I interviewed the people and read the texts and stuff, I saw a political story emerging like that, which is the way in which these very brilliant people made a claim to being human first, and then they took advantage of the affection in which they were held in their own communities and families to add to their power. But it was not, I mean, gay people were just as much a part of families and neighborhoods and friendships in 1950 as they were in 2012, but they certainly weren't treated the same way. So they had a lot of political work to do first.
Mm.
The other thing is, I wonder how upright it is in America to care more about people because they're your neighbor or your friend or your family member. I actually embrace this movement because I'm an American and I believe in the principles of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and they really require us to treat all Americans as fully human.
I was taken by the news coverage this morning and last night that Anderson Cooper came out and said, I'm gay. And I bring this up because there was a did you read the Entertainment Weekly article?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Entertainment Weekly last week did an article about gay actors coming out in the new style, which is sort of very understated, of just kind of slipping it in an article as,
right,
you know, as a gay man, I was struck by the article. One of the things that disturbed me a bit about it, though, was that of using it as a business model, if you will, and also kind of a miss to me, dismissing, you know, that there was a necessity for people, for actors to come out very quickly, and it just struck me as interesting because it seems that for many, it's a very difficult decision, and that should not be understated.
Right. I think it's wrong to understate it. Anderson Cooper's entitled to lead his life anyway he wants to. If he's going to come out, I did not think it should be made out to be such a simple, easy matter. Even young gay people, I had dinner last night with a young gay man, he's in his 30s. And of course, since I wrote this book, the subject comes
right
up. And even in his 30s, he was recounting stories of being treated really badly as a youth and at work, even now. And so I think it's really important for people to understand that this is not just a casual fact of the matter. I wish it were, but it's not just whether I have brown eyes or hazel eyes. It carries a lot of social price with it. And so coming out is a courageous act. I believe that people should do it. The more people come out, the lower the price of the next coming out.
Right.
Okay. So it's really, really important for people to come out. But I don't think that Anderson Cooper, a very wealthy and talented and privileged individual, story should be taken as generic.
Yeah.
I would never underestimate the difficulty of gay people's lives, even now in the victory era.
I was talking in an interview with a woman who was a school teacher, and we were talking about bullying, and she was discussing the issue of bullying in teachers between students and certainly students who are gay and that have identified themselves that way and the bullying that they have in schools. And the interview took a turn when she said, you know, as a gay teacher, I face the same bullying from my peers.
Right.
And I don't feel comfortable coming out with my colleagues while they are telling me how to teach tolerance to these kids.
You know,
and I was stunned by that.
But I'm not. I'm not surprised.
Well, no.
Right. Because I'm a straight person myself, and as I would go around carrying the books that I was reading for my book that I was writing under my arm, I'd take the airplane or the bus or whatever.
Right.
And I would see the responses of people. And since I myself had not grown up gay, I wasn't hardened to it, okay? I had not steeled myself against it. And when I saw how they acted toward me, thinking I was gay because I was carrying a copy of Gay New York or whatever under my arm, I was enabled to sympathize with my subjects in a way that I think I would not otherwise have done. And so it's around us. It's always going to be around us. Victory does not mean that every person's heart has been changed. What it means is that the basic political structure has now moved to a place where official homophobic laws and policies are going to eventually disperse. And once you do that, then the danger goes way down. And people are left with just the uncontrollable evil inclinations of other people's hearts. But it is the young man that I had dinner with last night was telling me about the verbal abuse that he takes. And I said to him, well, in 1969, Martin Boyce was afraid to walk down the streets of New York, and he and his pals would go to the corner and peek around to see if it was safe, because they were being beaten and in some cases shot to death in New York City. At least the things that you're afraid of now, which are terrible, are verbal. It's not that you think to yourself, should I walk down that street?
Right.
That's a big change.
Absolutely. And as you say, then that starts to disperse and erode and go away. Hopefully we can take the term gaydar with it. Be happy when that gets eradicated.
You know, everybody has a term they hate.
Yeah. Linda Hirschman is the author of Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution. It's published by Harper. It's a beautiful book. It's beautifully written, and the stories you tell and the people that you interview, it's truly stunning.
It was my honor to meet them.
I bet. Again, Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution by Linda Hirschman, published by Harper. Linda Hirschman will be talking about and signing her book this Sunday, July 8th, from 4 to 5 p.m. at the Roelof Janssen Community Library in Copaig. You can go to it's Roejan Library, R-O-E-J-A-N, R-O-E-J-A-N Library.org for more information, roejanlibrary.org. Linda Hirschman, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for
Thank
being with
you.
Us.
Thank you. Pleasure was mine.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.